Welcome to Hindsight. I'm Michelle Rayner. Today's program looks at the life and ideas of an intriguing individual in Australian history. A leader whose final years were spent in obscurity. A wartime activist whose main preoccupation was peace. A renowned speaker whose voice, alas, was never recorded. Her name is Vida Goldstein. A friend of the writer Miles Franklin, she carved out a part for herself in Australia's political narrative, where women had previously only sat on the sidelines. Today's Hindsight, Standing for Her Convictions, The Campaigns of Vida Goldstein, is presented by Jennifer Bowen. Vida Goldstein. Vida. Vida Goldstein.
She became the first full-time paid organiser for the United Council for Women's Suffrage.
Vida Goldstein.
And then, of course, she edited the Australian Women's Sphere for 5 years. And she founded the Women's Federal Political Association. But then she did what nobody else had done. She stood for election to the Senate.
Vida Goldstein.
She was the first woman in the British Empire to nominate for a federal parliament.
What a glorious campaign it was. Something to remember for all time. I thought nothing could have been more interesting than my Senate campaigns in 1903 and 1910. But this campaign for the House of Representatives outrivaled the others in every respect.
She was very consciously a modern woman, and although there were big differences, of course, in first and second wave feminism, a lot of the issues were similar.
Vida Goldstein is a precursor in a lot of ways of what was going to happen in the 20th century in warfare.
That commitment to social justice and social change really defined her.
It is my earnest hope that women in all parts of the world will stand together, demanding a more reasonable and civilised way of dealing with international disputes.
I did history honours at university but didn't actually encounter very many women, and I was actually came across the Women's Peace Army, and the concept of a Women's Peace Army was new to me and unusual, and I did a bit of research and quickly discovered that Vida Goldstein was the person who was behind all that, and a little bit more research suddenly found all the other wonderful things that she'd done, so I was hooked.
Melbourne historian Jeanette Bomford, author of a much-cited biography of Vida Goldstein. If the Women's Peace Army was the initial lure for her research, it doesn't disappoint. The Peace Army in many ways encapsulates the characteristics of Vida Goldstein's public life. Her commitment to women, the courage with which she held her convictions. This was an anti-war group founded shortly after Gallipoli. And the vigour, almost rigour, with which she campaigned. Much about Vida Goldstein gives her a contemporary feel, but she's also the product of the past. Many of her concerns are still current, but some of her thinking speaks of another time. For the present, her part in Australian public life is being keenly analysed. Professor Joy DeMussy, Head of History at Melbourne University.
I think the women's movement in the late 19th and early 20th century was really looking for women like Goldstein, in other words, someone who perhaps was young and energetic and progressive.
And Professor Shirley Swain of the Australian Catholic University.
She makes a difference because she's articulate and well-read. So she's able to bring into a world that's not well-informed about what's happening outside Australia, she's able to bring those ideas in.
Breaking the rules the way she did, it's not for the faint of heart.
Professor Susan McGarry of Adelaide University.
Women weren't supposed to be getting up on platforms. Vida was a young and attractive woman talking about the sorts of things that a great many men thought women shouldn't bother their pretty heads with.
She was pretty, she was fair, tailor-made and debonair. She was clever, she was bright, and her politics were right. She was gifted in her speech, she had mighty truths to teach. But one thing she had a-missing, which the legislator wants, and I almost blush to name it, but she really hadn't pants. No, she hadn't, really hadn't. Poor Vida hadn't pants. The great Australian nation, though it loves to woo and flirt, will never bend its noddle to unmitigated skirt.
I was born in the year 1869 at Portland in Alma Cottage, Hurd Street.
When she was 10, it was suggested to Vida Goldstein by her father that she write her autobiography. While many other personal papers were not kept, this one was.
About a very enjoyable birthday I spent at Portland.
Her father was a businessman, her mother wealthy. Later there were three sisters and a brother. It was a comfortable family life.
I've had a lot of people think that she was Jewish, but she never actually identified as Jewish. Her father's side of the family was Polish Jews, and they went to Ireland, where her father was born. And Jacob came to Australia alone at the age of 19 and settled around the Portland area, and that's where he met Isabella Hawkins, who was a young 18-year-old heiress. Very beautiful. I think it was a love match. He was 10 years older and they married in 1868.
As I am only a little girl of 10 years old, although I think myself a grown person, I have not a long account to give of myself.
She was a very loved first child, and there's early photographs of her looking extremely confident, and you can almost see the future politician. I think they had expectations that she would be capable of earning her own living or having a career if that was what she chose to do.
Please follow my example and begin when you were as young to give an account of yourself.
There was also the expectation that she would give back to the less fortunate, and from an early age she was involved in the same sort of campaigns as her mother was for the suffrage and for charity purposes.
Both her parents were interested in social reform. Historian Margaret Geddes. They moved to Melbourne and they became members of the Scots Church congregation, which was led by the Reverend Dr. Charles Strong, who in the 1880s in Melbourne was quite an influential figure. When wilt thou save the people? He's described as the father of the Australian peace movement. And he was deeply concerned with the betterment of society. He was expelled by conservative forces within the Melbourne Presbyterian hierarchy in about 1883, and the Goldstein family and many other members of his congregation followed him into the Australian Church, which was formed in the 1880s. Vida was educated at home until her final year when she went to Presbyterian Ladies' College and matriculated. The family fortunes, along with a lot of people's fortunes in the 1890s, fell. And I suspect that she may have had ambitions to go to university, but that was no longer affordable. So on matriculation, she became a teacher. And during the 1890s, she and her two sisters set up a school in East St Kilda, a co-educational school.
Education is a theme that resounds throughout Vida Goldstein's life, almost as if it's a duty to inform and to be informed. It's in her early journalism, her activism, and of course her later electoral campaigning.
Do not condemn me unheard. Read what I have to say to you. Come to my meetings. Write to me. Cast a thinking vote, a conscientious vote.
But during Vida's growing up, women's participation in political life was very limited. They couldn't vote, they couldn't stand for election. But they could agitate for change. Vida's governess was a suffragist, as was her mother, Isabella.
In the 1880s, women who were interested in getting the vote began to form societies, and their work culminated in 1891 when a suffrage bill was before the Victorian Parliament. and the women decided to gather a petition. This was Vida's initiation into public life when she helped her mother collect the signatures. And the women all around Victoria managed to collect 33,000 signatures, and it became known as the Monster Petition because it was so large it needed several people to carry it into the halls of Parliament. Vida said later that this was a great learning experience for her because she had to learn to argue why women should have the vote when she was knocking on doors.
She was the first paid organiser at 30 shillings a week for the United Council of Women's Suffrage. She formed Women's Progressive Leagues, which were a network of suburban groups that debated matters of citizenship and women's rights.
Suffrage historian Farley Kelly.
Women's clubs and women's societies were extremely new and to many men very confronting, because going out of your house, going unaccompanied, meeting other women for serious purposes was something that was radical.
To what extent was there opposition to what she was doing?
It wasn't very hard for the Conservatives to raise a large petition in opposition to the suffrage. They raised 24,000 signatures in 2 months. They didn't want working women and their own maids voting. Even men like Jacob Goldstein, who supported the women doctors, actually, felt that invading the public realm of politics was a betrayal of what he felt was true womanliness.
Just what did constitute womanliness was a contentious subject at the time. Part of Vida Goldstein's appeal to women was based on the idea of some fundamental commonality as women.
That all women at core are the same, and the sameness is that they all have babies, they all can all be mothers. And there's one level of feminism which, in a lot of ways, Vida's suffrage activity identifies with, which is the equal rights feminism, that we're equal to men, therefore we should have the same rights. This is a different branch of feminism, which is commonly labelled maternalist feminism, where you're saying we should have special rights because we're women and potential mothers. It's most clearly expressed here through the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is, of course, the big power behind suffrage in terms of getting the shock troops out. And all of the claims that they make is that as women, we have interests different from men. Our responsibility is to police the social world. So we want the vote to vote in responsible men who implement our policies. They don't want to go into Parliament themselves, which Vida did. They just think if we vote for good men, all will be well.
I think those times were characterised by a quite remarkable polarisation of the sexes. And I think that's part of what generated first wave feminism. It was running at the same time as what could be called a strike against motherhood. Women were profoundly unhappy with the way they were being treated sexually. And that meant in marriage as well as outside. I don't think the sexes are anything like as polarised at present. Suffragists of that period had real difficulty. They were asking for equal rights for men and women, and they were being able to demonstrate quite clearly that men had lots of rights that women didn't have access to. The vote was a symptom and a symbol of all of that. But of course, at the same time, they argued that there were essential differences between the sexes. Some of those differences were presented as women being morally superior, and so it would be a very good thing if women set about doing world's housekeeping, because what this would do is clean up men's acts. They would have to become more moral. They would be raised to the higher moral level of women. Vida was quite capable of using that argument.
There was obviously pamphlets and booklets that were coming out. It's documents she spent a lot of time in the public library. She was also very keen on sitting in the visitors section at Parliament, listening to parliamentary debates, so she was getting sort of an education there as well.
Women's suffrage would abolish soldiers and war, also racing, hunting, football, cricket, and all such manly games. Are we going to allow women who would sap the very foundations of a nation to have votes? Frank Madden, Member of the Legislative Assembly, 1895.
She would have sat at lectures. That's what they did. They went and heard each other's lectures. She probably would have gone to the Wesley Pleasant Sunday Afternoons, which many people remember because they were broadcast well through to the 1960s. And it was a kind of meeting where you had songs, you had visiting performers, but you also had speakers, and they would address social issues.
The concerns of the day were changing. Different theories about the nature of society, work, education and gender. Poverty, for instance, was seen as a problem in need of a solution, with a debate that's still running today.
In the 19th century, it's about well-meaning women, clergymen's wives, people like that, who are charitable. So they go out and give out material relief. Vida Goldstein's interest is more theoretical. She's associating with women who are thinking about the problems of women and children. So she's theorising it, and she's interested in social change. So she's a thinker. Now, we have to say on the other side of that as well, this new generation are also single women who are looking to create themselves jobs. Not necessarily paid jobs, but speaking positions, the right to speak about something. Women who've been educated and are looking for a way to exercise those skills and talents they've developed, she's trying to carve out a room for them.
Is that partly because there simply weren't jobs for this cohort of women, insofar as they wouldn't become servants and they wouldn't work in factories?
Yeah. I mean, how do you actually become a professional woman? That's the big question, because teaching and nursing, and teaching, if you could get yourself back into the girls' private school network, you could be an educated woman of some distinction. But the ones working in the state system, they're slogging it up from being pupil teachers at 14. And similarly, nursing, while it's an occupation for ladies, is a very lowly occupation in the way it's exercised. So you can imagine she and her friends looking around thinking, we've got all this education, what do we do with it? And then reading and hearing about overseas, saying, well, that's what's happening over there. Perhaps we can articulate something here.
We need hardly remind you that in all the up-to-date public institutions for children in Europe and the United States, women inspectors are considered essential. However well-intentioned men inspectors may be, they cannot understand the needs of children as women can and do.
It was quite common for her to attend court cases when she knew that there were young women who were before the courts who had no legal representation. Sometimes that could be for prostitution or trying to get child support for an illegitimate baby or something like that. And Vida built up an expertise in sort of legal knowledge of these sorts of cases and was able to help the young women. Vida was unusual in attending those cases, and there's actually newspaper reports where the women who do go to these court cases to support other women were seen as being disreputable themselves.
Never have the women's societies that are agitating for paid women inspectors and more scientific methods of treating the whole neglected children's question received an atom of help from the ladies' committees. Indeed, certain committees have persistently blocked all efforts at reform.
Vida Goldstein contended with opposition all her public life. But on the other hand, support came from far and wide, including outside Australia. In 1902, Australian women were granted the right to vote in federal elections. And in the same year, Vida made her first trip overseas.
Yes, she was invited to be the Australian delegate to the International Suffrage Conference in Washington, D.C. in 1902, and this gave her an international reputation. And when she arrived at the conference, she was seen as a remarkable example of an enfranchised woman.
Vida made her mark. The editor of a Boston paper composed a song for her.
It's interesting, women seem to have been internationalists. They seem to have seen sisterhood across the nations as quite important. It wasn't just European women. They joined with Indian women, women from all parts of Africa, all sorts of places.
There was a very strong sense of belonging to a global movement, which gave, I think, power and support to any of the local or national campaigns.
I shall never forget the moment of my meeting that wonderful woman, Susan Anthony. She is 82 years of age, and for over 50 years, one of the foremost in the suffrage fight.
Vida Goldstein was elected secretary of the international organisation at the conclusion of the conference. But it wasn't the end of her business in America.
She was asked by the Victorian government to investigate the methods of dealing with neglected and delinquent children in the States while she was there. The Criminology Society asked her to report back on the US penal system. The Trades Hall Council asked her to look at American unions and report on their effectiveness. Then the New South Wales branch of the National Council of Women nominated her as their delegate to attend a conference of International Council of Women, which followed the suffrage conference. So she clearly had sort of wide connections with various aspects of society who saw her as a very useful and effective spokesperson and investigator on their behalf.
When she came back, she gave illustrated lectures of her tour to America, and she called it To America and Back, and she was rather entertaining speaker. She'd go around various places in Victoria giving this talk and charging admittance, and people were fascinated by it.
Vida Goldstein was 34 years old. She could speak to a hall full of people. She was recognised for her expertise in matters of social welfare. She was ready when a federal election was called in Australia.
1903, and she was invited by the Women's Political Association to stand as their candidate. This was history-making. She was the first woman in the British Empire to nominate for a federal parliament. She saw it as very much a good opportunity to set an example, to show that women really could stand for parliament, that they were also socially capable of standing up to be a politician.
As soon as my candidature was announced, the enemy prophesied a physical breakdown and humiliating insults from men at my meetings. From all accounts, I stood the racket of the campaign better than most of the candidates. After 1 month's work, the voices of many were tattered and torn. Mine was as fresh and clear the night before the battle as it was when I started skirmishing 3 months previously.
She was very well organised. She had a group of women to be her campaign committee. They organised a tour of Victoria for her. She visited 30 country towns. Sometimes it would be nicely organised for her, but quite often it wasn't. She'd arrive and the hall hadn't been booked or something like that. It was a brave thing to do. And as she went on, you can read from the newspaper clippings that she gains in confidence and she becomes a very witty and very accomplished speaker.
Miss Goldstein presented a very pleasing appearance on the platform at Avoca. She was graceful, prettily gowned, and wore a most becoming hat, the Ararat Advertiser, 27th of October 1903.
Dark hair dressed low upon her forehead, but not absurdly low. Sparkling dark eyes, which are very much on the alert, especially when an elector ventures a question. Prettily flushed face, nicely featured, and a very attractive smile.
I think Goldstein's real talent was in her ability to project a fairly conventional femininity on the platform, and through her voice, which was non-threatening and certainly easy to listen to and very charming and compelling, that she could actually literally gain an ear. She had to make a very concerted effort to counter the representation of women in politics at the time, and the shrieking suffragettes, the shrieking sisterhood, was often the label that was put on women who were trying to get women the vote. So her talent, I think, was to try and counter those images, present both an acceptable representation of women in politics, and I think her voice played a major part in that.
She is nice to look at, and absolutely delightful to listen to. The quick, eager way she has of rising to answer questions has its charms, for you see there the enthusiast. Her smartness at repartee is a rare gift. Her composure when signs of disturbance appear, and the way she has of getting off a slap at the other side, without in the least descending from the pedestal she, as a lady, stands on, are worth seeing and hearing. West Gippsland Gazette, 1st of December, 1903.
She was seen as a novelty, but again, I think what she did cleverly was present herself as a novelty very conservatively so that she wasn't threatening, so the journalists would then be able to say, well, actually, she's just like anybody else. She tried to challenge that attention by normalising her mode of operating, because actually what she was saying was incredibly challenging, incredibly radical for the time. And in order to get a positive coverage, in order to get people to come and hear her, not as a freak, but as someone who they generally want to hear with something to say, she orchestrated, I think, her public image beautifully in that regard.
She polled 51,000 votes, which was about half the number of votes of the leading candidate. So 51,000 people were prepared to vote for her, which I think is pretty impressive. On the actual list, she was 15th out of 18 candidates. So she said she was beaten but not disgraced, and I think that's a good summary of it.
How Vida Goldstein really felt after this first Senate campaign isn't clear. For all the energy she put into public life, she kept her private self out of the spotlight, even after her death, when most of her letters and personal papers were found to be missing. That she'd maintained an extensive correspondence isn't in doubt, particularly with the writer Stella Miles Franklin. It's in a letter to Miles Franklin that there's an early clue to her interest in Christian Science, to which she converted at some point.
Science makes one look at the troubles of this life from an entirely new viewpoint, and one realizes the beautiful truth in those lines. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Letter to Miles Franklin, 1904.
Vida Goldstein never married, and there's no suggestion of any intimate relationship. There was some estrangement between her parents over the very issue of women's suffrage. Otherwise, the family was close.
They were interesting. It always makes me think more of New York than Australia, because Australia is so essentially suburban. She and her two sisters and their mother lived in adjoining apartments in an apartment building in the middle of Melbourne.
It was a setup that included her brother-in-law, an Englishman, Henry Hyde Champion.
In 1898, he married Vida's sister, Elsie. He was a journalist. He was involved with all the leaders of the new left in England, the Fabians and the Social Democratic Federation and so on. There have been theories advanced that Hyde Champion originally preferred Vida over Elsie, but it would have been a disaster. The egos would have been too much of a clash. Vida would have learned a good deal about publishing and a good deal about speaking from him. But Vida would also have learned from Hyde's experience what not to do, because he could be abrasive, he could be seen as divisive, his personal style could be somewhat off-putting.
Vida's leadership was strong across the first decade of the century. There was plenty of work to do, a succession of campaigns written up in her newspaper, The Woman Voter.
The Women's Political Association takes exception to the...
We ask for an immediate introduction of a marriage and divorce law equal for men and women.
We support that request and ask that women be appointed to the commission.
We desire that Australian woman artists be given equal opportunities with men to submit their work for the new Commonwealth offices.
In 1910, Vida decided to stand for the Senate again, and she had greater confidence this time, a more professional organisation. She polled slightly better, but not significantly better. She was non-party. She didn't align herself with either the fusionists or the protectionists, Liberal or Labor, as we'd said. Now, in a way, that was her downfall because she didn't have the backing that a federal political party would have had.
I don't say that I was officially approached, but I was informed by those I regarded as representatives of both parties that if I joined their party, my entry into Parliament was assured. But I despise party government, and I would not join one body or the other. The Weekly Times, the 23rd of April, 1910.
I think it was both principled and pragmatic. She was actually very close to Labor, but you've got to remember that the political parties were only really consolidating at that period. To engage too much with one group risked putting the others off. That's the pragmatic part of it. But also there's a principle of women supporting women and combining to work on issues. That, in fact, was the position taken by women's electoral lobby in the 1970s. Everyone was lobbied for an issue.
When Vida attended the American Suffrage Conference, she met a lot of the main suffrage leaders from England and remained in contact with them. And even though the vote had been won in Australia, Vida very much was passionate about women having the vote internationally and kept up a friendship and correspondence with the leaders in America and Britain. And in 1911, the Pankhursts, who were the militant suffragettes in England, invited Vida to come and help with their organisation. They invited her partly because of her international reputation and partly because she'd already had the experience of winning the suffrage, and they hoped that her experience would help them with their battles for the vote.
I have addressed three Albert Hall meetings. Each one has had its own special characteristic, but each has had an exalted sense of the sisterhood of women, a conception of liberty and justice that the world does not yet understand.
She was an organiser. She went around to a lot of their public speaking engagements. She was seen to be an expert, and she was also put in charge of the foreign contingent of a huge demonstration that was held there in June 1911. There was 40,000 women in this procession, and most of them were dressed in white with the suffrage colours of purple, white and green. So it must have been a spectacular thing to have been part of.
I go to carry our work in Australia. For it is our work. We suffragists are one all the world over. The principles for which we stand and of which the vote is only a small symbol have to be woven into the national life everywhere.
On the curb at the corner of Swanston and Collins Street in the rush hour stood a young, attractive woman selling newspapers. For 15 minutes I watched this amazing spectacle. It was 1912, and only boys sold newspapers in Melbourne streets in this era. Most passers-by did not see her. Groups of girls looked sideways and tittered. Occasionally a man would stop and give a disapproving grunt. I did not see one person buy a paper. May Maxwell.
We got our papers. In the evening, we took our stand in Chapel Street, Paran. Men stood by watching, wondering. At last, one, an elderly man, came forward and bought a paper. I expressed my gratitude. He took off his hat and with a bow said with great respect, "The debt is all on my side," showing that he understood what it meant to stand in the gutter for one's convictions.
In 1913, she had the opportunity to stand for the House of Representatives seat of Kooyong. There was only one other candidate. It was also a seat that had had the most number of women electors in it and had given her the highest number of votes in the previous campaign, so that was part of why she chose it. But she was very disappointed with that actual campaign, that it didn't attract the media publicity that it had beforehand, and she really struggled to get attention.
To the electors of Kooyong, 1912. No stone is being left unturned to induce you to vote against me. Because I am a woman. Because I am a non-party politician. Because I am a progressive politician.
The actual election, she got about 11,000 votes and her opponent got about 18,000. And 1914, she repeated the exercise in Kooyong, again unsuccessfully.
I heartily congratulate Sir Robert on his victory. But, while he won, we were not defeated. We have simply passed another milestone on the road to justice.
Justice really was a fundamental part of her concerns. She was incredibly innovative and original, I think, in formulating the cultural and social problems of the day, but doing so in a way that would pinpoint where she believed there were inequities and injustices. I think the Justice Party is really crucial to understanding really how she became involved in what she became involved in, and also how she responded to the shifting times and the historical moment that she was part of, which I think she really appreciated. I think she understood history very, very well and understood what she was doing as historic.
Campaigns for women's suffrage, for welfare reform, for women's work and family had, if you like, the blessing of history. Not so, though, Vida Goldstein's position on war. She was a pacifist before and throughout the First World War, uncompromising in her position.
Vida spoke out against the Boer War in 1899, and that would have been her first involvement with the anti-war movement. But there was also a form of, I suppose it was cadets really, sort of military conscription in schools. Boys from 14 to 18 at school had compulsory military training, and there was a fair amount of opposition to that.
Vida came out very early with a declaration against the war, and she made it very clear within her Women's Political Association that she opposed the war and that she opposed compulsory military conscription. And in fact, this proved very divisive because many of her members actually had sons or husbands at war. So this is one reason why she established the Women's Peace Army, because she was trying to isolate her anti-war work and her political work.
I believe that war is a degradation of motherhood, an economic futility, and a crime against civilization and humanity. I therefore pledge myself to active service in the cause of peace by working against compulsory military training and every form of militarism. Further, I solemnly pledge myself to face unflinchingly adverse criticism and persecution for my faith, that love and justice alone will bring peace to the world.
10 million soldiers to the war have gone, who may never return again.
The Women's Peace Army was quite small. I think there were about 80 who signed up when it was first established. The women worked on campaigning for peace. They would go around giving talks about ending the war and the peace movement. They had wonderful songs, I Didn't Raise My Son to Be a Soldier, that Vida's friend Cecilia John would sing.
Cecilia John, who was one of the office bearers in the army, had a beautiful voice. She was a singing teacher before she joined the Peace Army. She was a member of the Unitarian Church. Her uncle was a minister with the Unitarian Church. Her first anti-war work was actually, she was opposed to the compulsory military training for schoolboys. She happened to be a resident in the Kooyong electorate. She became interested in Vida's campaign and joined the Women's Political Association. And then when the Peace Army started, she was one of the forces in that.
In the early years of the War Precautions Act was passed, and it affected Vida because as an editor of a newspaper, The Woman Voter, she had to submit all her copy to the censor before publication. But later in the war, when Prime Minister Billy Hughes introduced more severe censorship, Vida published The Empty Spaces. At another time, she used the blank spaces to put Mr. Hughes Says We May Have a Free Press.
Women are not going to be made into breeding machines for the god of war, for women will ever increasingly refuse to give life that men may then take it.
The military police would also send people to attend public meetings, but they only had two people who could take shorthand. And so very soon all the peace activists learnt to recognise these two people standing at the back of the hall taking notes. So what it's meant is that we now have some of Vida's speeches kept in the archives through this.
I think it is a fearful reflection on 2,000 years of Christianity that men have rushed into war before using every combined effort to prevent this appalling conflict. It is my earnest hope that women in all parts of the world will stand together, demanding a more reasonable and civilized way of dealing with international disputes.
Why she opposed war was that one mother or potential mother shouldn't send her son to kill another mother's child. So it was all about women as life givers, and that's really where her arguments about peace come from.
If you look at the sort of feminism she was interested in and she promoted, it very much was a feminism based on social justice, but almost like a Christian feminism as well, and there's a sort of Christian theme. And I think the Peace Army and the whole war transforms really her type of feminism. Earlier it was much more around industrial relations and the workplace and so on, more a materialist left-wing sort of orientation, which never leaves her, but I think the war really defines a different type of feminism.
The Women's Peace Army was located in the centre of Melbourne in the Guildhall, about half a mile from Flinders Street Station. It was very much part of Melbourne and the Melbourne scene. And it was from the Guildhall that Vida, during World War I, ran a commune during the Wharf Labourers' Strike, which went for several months in 1916-1917. During the war years, the price of food had gone up dramatically, but wages hadn't matched them. The wharf labourers eventually went on strike seeking better wages and conditions. And of course, this was seen as unpatriotic by many people. But Vida, again, sympathised with the working man and the women who were being affected by this. She set up this commune and managed to get donations of food so that she could provide meals for the wharf labourers and their families. It's said that she handed out 60,000 food parcels and organised for 30,000 meals.
The Women's Peace Army activists like Adela Pankhurst, who was of course one of the Pankhursts, who'd been banished to Australia in 1914 and welcomed by Vida Goldstein and became part of the Peace Army, and Cecilia John, they went interstate and campaigned, and there was a Peace Army in Sydney and a group in Brisbane.
When they were involved in the Women's Peace Army, she and Cecilia John had, I think, picked up from the suffragettes the enormous value of the kind of theatricality that the suffragettes used in their marches, so that in one of the marches, one of the peace marches Vida Goldstein and Cecilia John organised, they had Cecilia John at the head of a march of some 5,000 women, and she was on a horse and carrying a staff with a flag with the colours of purple, green and white, which of course were the Women's Peace Army colours. Now, this must have been a stunning appearance.
Every woman has got to have a say before they can send a man away. So I want you all to know why the women will say no to Mr. Hughes on referendum day.
Billy Hughes announced that there'd be a referendum on conscription in 1916. One of the main things that Vida was involved with was the Women's No Conscription procession. This was a huge procession, and it's the first known time that Australian women marched in a peace demonstration. The procession was led by an 8-year-old child, Madeleine Gardner, daughter of Edith, who was a vice president of the Women's Political Association. And she was dressed in white and held a dove of peace. And following Madeleine was Celia John on horseback, and she was wearing white and had the suffrage colours. And behind Cecilia, there was trucks and lorries that were decorated with no conscription slogans. Children right through to old ladies.
Remember what your men would have you do. Don't forget the day.
Melbourne had never seen the likes of it before. But of course, not everyone agreed with them, and there was a lot of returned soldiers who were very antagonised by this, and they marched along Swanston Street, and by the time they got to the Flinders Street Bridge, some of the returned soldiers started attacking the women and children on the floats, and there's accounts of women being hit with umbrellas. One woman had part of her finger bitten off by a soldier. Madeleine, I interviewed her, and she said she was walking very slowly, doing the right thing at the front of the march, and all of a sudden these huge wharf labourers came and picked her up and put her on their shoulders, and she was very upset because she wanted to be doing the right thing and leading the march. But she found out later that the word had gone out to throw the kid in the Yarra. So the wharf labourers had come to protect her.
And when you say that you interviewed her, when was this?
Yes, when I started my research on Vida Goldstein's biography, that would have been the late 80s, and I actually tracked down this little girl, who then was in her 80s, of course, and we had a wonderful afternoon, and she remembered lovely things about Vida, and she always said that Vida would always say to her, "You'll be our first woman Prime Minister."
Conscripts our men will never be. We're going to defend their liberty. And I want you all to know, and I want you all to know, that my answer will be no.
The Woman Voter, April the 19th, 1917. Fellow citizens, for the third time, I ask you to return me as a member of the Senate. I am nominated by the Women's Political Association and by the Women's Peace Army, with the objects of bringing forward in Parliament questions affecting women and children, which men have ignored because they don't understand them.
Her final election campaign was in 1917 when she stood for the Senate. And that campaign, there were a lot of other issues by this time, and she polled so badly that she lost her deposit in that final one.
The war concluded in November 1918. Men returned home, women to homemaking. As the Allies assembled in Paris to determine reparations, women from around the world met in Geneva for a peace conference.
The Women's Peace Conference for Vida was so moving because she saw women of warring nations coming together and being not only friendly but warm to each other. And this was such a contrast to what was happening at the peace conference in Paris, where the Allies imposed such harsh conditions on the Germans and were so punitive and humiliated them. There's lovely stories that Vida said that stayed in her memory of when the first woman from northern France arrived and a German woman came up and handed her some roses. And it was that friendship and compassion. And the French woman said, "It is not your country that is responsible for the atrocities. C'est la guerre, c'est la guerre." And Vida said there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And even now I sort of find it very emotional just to read that.
What was happening during and after the war was women were becoming much more involved in politics. But the feminist organisations tended to be international ones, and more they were joining the political parties. And so what had been meetings of suffrage organisations grew smaller and smaller and smaller and were eroded as the women moved into the political parties.
After the Women's Peace Conference, she was very much wanting to do more work for international peace. And I think she was also disillusioned in some ways and tired. She'd had her five political campaigns. She'd worked very hard during the war to help people. She returned to England and lived there for several years. There's not a lot recorded of those years.
Well, she didn't have much of a role in public life after the end of the First World War. She wrote a few articles and stayed put until she'd come to terms with what the world faced her with, and then travelled home and disengaged politically and set up as a Christian Science healer.
She spoke out against the atomic bomb during World War II, but she lived quietly with her sisters, and she died in 1949 at the age of 80, and she, in line with her beliefs, she was cremated.
Vida Goldstein's death passed almost unnoticed, and it was some years before her life caught the eye of historians. There's been some frustration at the absence of a personal diary or cache of letters. But her ideas are clearly articulated, leaving a philosophy of life and a life lived as example.
She was the first star, wasn't she, really?
She was a great progressive, one of the great progressives of her day.
I think her great contribution was showing what a woman could do.
Vida. Vida Goldstein. Vida Goldstein.
Today's Hindsight, Standing for Her Convictions, The Campaigns of Vida Goldstein, was produced by Jennifer Bowen, and the sound engineer was Russell Thompson. Special thanks to Jeanette Bomford and to all those who took part in today's program. Thanks also to Diana and Meredith Cratemore for access to Vida Goldstein's childhood autobiography. Louise Silverson read from the writings of Vida Goldstein. Other readings were by Lucy Dodds, Nell Feeney and Gary Files. Songs were performed by Judy Mallinson, accompanied by John Mallinson. And if you'd like more information about Vida Goldstein, then do head to the Hindsight website, where you'll find images and references galore. That's abc.net.au/rn, and follow the prompts to Hindsight.
Charles Darwin turns 200 and he continues to provoke controversy. But what does Charles Darwin have to do with caveman psychology, the meaning of life, or George Bernard Shaw? Excavate Darwinian thought at the Radio National website. Podcasts, transcripts, and gene pool, where your contributions evolve and mutate. Charles Darwin turns 200. Evolving Radio at the ABC Radio National website.